The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Richard Martin of the Wake Up Call coming to you on Monday, the 23rd of January from Singapore, and wishing you all a very happy Chinese New Year of the Dragon. Well, I'm going to spend about 20 minutes talking in some depth about Europe. Clearly, Europe is at the top of the agenda at the moment, and rightly so. There's been a lot of misinformation bandied about Europe, and I think it's time to set the record straight for my loyal listeners of the Wake Up Call. A lot of what I'm about to tell you is inspired by John Maudlin, who has the measure of Europe like no one else I read, with the exception of Mike Shedlock. Right now, Europe has three main problems. First of all, a growing number of its countries are either insolvent or close to it. It is increasingly likely that the only way forward is for defaults of some type to lessen the burden of debt to a level where it can be dealt with and that will allow the countries the possibility of growth, which is really the only answer to the problems they face. Secondly, because of growing fears of multiple defaults, just Greece would be bad enough, most of the banks in Europe are seen to be insolvent and in need of hundreds of billions of euros of new capital. See, the interbank market in Europe is in a shambles, and banks park their cash with the European Central Bank at a lower rate of return, as that's the only institution they trust. They clearly do not trust each other. And by the way, there are sources that say that European banks, especially French, are cutting back on their trade lending, which is making normal commerce much more difficult. And by the way, didn't we just go through that in 2008? Well, thirdly, the real problem in Europe is the massive trade imbalances between the peripheral countries and the so-called core countries. Without the ability to adjust currencies, those trade imbalances will render any debt solution moot, as a country cannot balance its budget while it runs a trade deficit and its citizens and businesses also deleverage. Now, this is an arithmetical problem which has been addressed on many occasions. You see, there must be balance, or there must be a mechanism to achieve balance. You can't solve one of these problems without solving all three. Either they all get done, or none of them do. You can kick the can down the road by solving problems one and two, but the third problem will put you shortly back to square one. Europe is now trying to address the first and second problems. They're talking about a new treaty that will require austerity of a real kind, although I understand that Germany has put in a clause that gives it some extra time to achieve its own balanced budget. And the European Central Bank is dispensing euros through the back door to banks in exchange for anything resembling collateral. Not directly, of course, as that is prohibited, but the same thing is being accomplished despite objections in some quarters, mostly German. Greece is negotiating aggressively with its lenders as to how much haircut they'll receive and what sort of guarantees Greece will provide on the remaining debt. They're balking at putting new bonds in a legal jurisdiction that will have some real bite if they default again, which they will. They're also negotiating with Europe about how much additional real austerity they will have to endure in order to be allowed to take on more debt. If they walk away and there is an uncoordinated default, it will guarantee chaos. Bank collateral will collapse and credit defaults will be triggered, including many sold by European banks that are already essentially insolvent. The legal euphemism here is that if debtors voluntarily accept a 50% haircut, that no credit default swap protections will be triggered on those positions. But not all parties want to voluntarily take that loss, or an even greater one. If they are forced to do so, then the credit default swaps they bought come into effect. Greece can legislatively force them to take the haircut. But CDS contracts are written in such a way that that action would be seen as a loss, triggering the CDS insurance. The governments involved want everyone to accept, so there's no crisis. The funds simply want as much money as they can get back, and many are playing a very hard-nosed game. The sad thing is that a 50% cut of the private lenders only gets Greece back to what will soon be 120% debt to GDP from the current 170% and rising. 120%, which I consider optimistic, is just another lesser form of insolvency, as Italy now understands. And if Italy is under pressure at 120%, then it's almost a given that the market would see Greece as still insolvent. There is at least one unintended consequence arising from the Greek settlement negotiations. Private investors thought they were buying a bond that was pari passu, or equal with all other Greek sovereign debt. It now turns out that they were buying junior, second-tier, subordinated debt. Something like a second mortgage on a home. You will take the first loss, so then you charge accordingly. But it now seems that the ECB, the European Central Bank, the IMF, and European public institutions are more equal than the private parties and will not have to share in the losses. The private lenders have found out that they were taking subordinated risks while only getting senior rate returns. If the public lenders were involved in the haircuts, then maybe it would only have to be a 30% haircut. Or if it was 50%, it would be enough to maybe get Greece to the point where it might have a chance, and the remainder of the debt would be in better shape, rather than this just being the negotiations for the first haircut with more to follow. Every private lender in Europe now recognizes they are taking more risk when they invest in a sovereign debt instrument. This will have the effect of pushing rates up in the private market, like they have very recently climbed for Portugal. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. So, ladies and gentlemen, Europe faces a set of choices. They can lend Greece more money on promises to turn things around, which can't happen because of, one, the very austerity being imposed, and two, the 10% of GDP trade imbalance with the rest of Europe. But if they don't lend the money, and there is an uncontrolled default, they will get to inspect that abyss more closely than they would like. It will mean hundreds of billions of euros in losses at their banks, which will have to be bailed out eventually by taxpayers. Europe is rightfully worried about contagion. If Greece gets a 50% reduction on its debt, Portugal will obviously point out that they deserve it more. They have been deep fiscal cuts by the free market government of Pedro Passos Coelho in an attempt to reduce the deficits. But estimates are that even with those cuts, the deficit will still be 6%, falling only to 4% in 2013. And that's if things go well. The market is not acting as if it expects things to go well. Yields on Portugal's 10-year bonds climbed to 14.39% on Thursday. Credit default swaps measuring bond risk have reached 1,270 points, pricing a two-thirds chance of default over the next 5 years. While Portugal's public debt of 113% of GDP is lower than Greece's, the public sector has much larger debts, and the country's total debt load is higher at 360% of GDP, much of it external debt. Jürgen Michels, Europe economist at Citigroup, says, and I quote, "Without a sizable haircut to its debt stock, Portugal will not be able to move into a viable fiscal path. We expect a haircut of 35% at the end of 2012 or in 2013. End of quote. Ambrose Evans Pritchard, whose columns I try never to miss, writes in the London Telegraph as follows, "Portugal is a troubling case for EU officials, who insist that Greece is a one-off case rather than the first of a string of countries trapped in a deeper north-south structural rift. The official line is that Portugal will pull through because it has grasped the nettle of retrenchment and reform. Europe's leaders have vowed that there will be no forced haircuts for holders of Portuguese bonds. If the country now spirals into a Grecian vortex as well, they will have to repudiate that promise or accept that European Union taxpayers will have to shoulder the burden of debt restructuring. While all eyes are on Greece, it is the slower drama in Portugal that will ultimately determine the fate of the Eurozone." End of quote. It will be impossible for Greece to turn around without being able to resort to a currency devaluation. They have to endure a 30% pay cut relative to core Europe if they want to compete. There will be no volunteers in Greece for such cuts. After 2 years of IMF and European institutional involvement, otherwise known as meddling in Greece, there has hardly been any movement in Greek labor costs. Greece is not alone. Are you reading of any general pay cuts in the proposed solutions for Italy, where labor costs are now above those of Greece? Likewise, no move in Portugal. The entire Eurozone is out of balance, and no one is making any moves to deal with it, or even acknowledge the basic problem. Much of the establishment in Europe was predicting a positive GDP for the region only a month ago. The recent trend suggests the data they were smoking was hallucinogenic. And given the seriousness of the problem, it must have been primo stuff. Germany was in recession for the fourth quarter of last year and is likely to be there this quarter, which is the technical definition of a recession. Clearly, peripheral Europe is in a recession, and in some countries, it could be called a depression. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let me give you my information. The toll-free number for you to call in, if you are so inclined, is 888-874-4888. That's our toll-free number at Progressive Radio Network, open all the time and ready to receive your calls of any nature, hopefully of the constructive commentary kind, or perhaps even a question or two. Again, 888-874-4888 is your number. If you would rather write in your questions and comments by email, please feel free to do that as well. The email address, which is open at my desk permanently, is rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin, GFAWD.com, which stands for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design. Once again, the email, RM@GFAWD.com. And for those of you who would like to call in private to discuss your own personal issues, please feel free to call me anytime in the 24-hour day on 941-441-1682. That is a number in Sarasota, Florida. Again, 941-441-1682. All right, so just a quick word about the upcoming meetup group this Sunday, January the 29th, in New Brunswick, New Jersey. It will be held at the George Street Ale House at 378 George Street. And as always, please do contact Susan. She's the moderator, and if you want further details, she will have them, and please let her know you will be coming. Her number is 202-246-5131. So, again, 202-246-5131. All right, let's first of all see what the choices are that Europe faces right now. Let's take Greece, because it's actually instructive. Greece has two choices. They can choose disaster A, which is to say, stay in the euro, cutting spending and raising taxes so that they can qualify for yet another bailout, negotiating more defaults, getting further behind on their balance of payments, and suffering along with a lack of medicine, energy, and other goods they so desperately need. They will be mired in a depression for a generation. Demonstrations will get even larger and uglier as the government has to make even more cuts to deal with the decreasing revenues, as 2.5% of their GDP in euros leaves the country each month. There is a run on their banks. Any Greek who can is getting his money out. Greek voters will then blame whichever political group was responsible for choosing disaster A and vote them out as the opposition calls for Greece to exit the euro, which is, of course, disaster B. Leaving the euro is a nightmare of biblical proportions, equivalent to about 7 of the 10 plagues that visited Egypt. First, there is a banking holiday. Then all accounts are converted to drachmas, and all pensions and government pay is now in drachmas. What about the private contacts made in euros with non-Greek businesses? And it is one thing to convert all the electronic money and cash in the banks, but how do you get Greeks to turn in their euros for drachmas when they can cross the border and buy goods at lower prices as inflation and or outright devaluation will follow any change of currency? It has to. That's the whole point. So how do you get Zorba and Demos to willingly turn in their remaining cash euros? You can close the borders, but that creates a black market for euros, and the Greeks have been smuggling through the hills for centuries. And how do you close the fishing villages where their cousin from Italy meets them in the Mediterranean for a little currency exchange? What about non-Greek businesses that built apartments or condos for them? They now get paid in depreciating drachmas while having to cover their euro costs back home. Not to mention, how do you get the hard currency to buy medicine, energy, food, military supplies, etc.? You see, the list just goes on and on. It is a lawyer's dream. Well, there is a third choice, disaster C, which is worse than both of the others. Greece can stay in the euro and default on all debt which cuts them off completely from the bond market for some time to come. This forces them to make drastic cuts in all government services and payments, salaries, pensions, etc., and suffer a capital D depression, as they must balance their trade payments overnight or do without. Then they choose disaster B anyway. No, the only real options are disaster A or disaster B. Whether they opt to go straight to the drachma, disaster B, is only a matter of timing. They will get there soon enough. Why then do they wait? What's the point of going through all these motions? Because Europe fears a disorderly disaster B. For the rest of Europe, it is the abyss. The Greek hope is that Europe, i.e. Germany, keeps funding them in order to keep back from the edge of the abyss. As one European diplomat noted, there is a growing sense that despite the valiant efforts of Papademos, the reluctant Greek establishment is biding its time to the next elections, banking on the assumption that the world will continue to bail them out no matter what. End of quote. So Europe is now getting closer and closer to the point where it must make a decision about what to do with Greece. In theory, the deadline is March the 20th for the next round of funding. It is a game with very high stakes and deadly serious players. Can French President Sarkozy be seen as weak and giving in to Greece with his own elections coming up in April? Can Merkel appear to give in and keep her troops in line? There are elections not long after that in Greece. Can Papademos cave in to further cuts and promises on future debt that will be hard to keep and intensely unpopular? The markets are getting exhausted. There will be no private market for Greek debt at any number close to what is sustainable. Greece will be on European life support for a very long time if they stay in and there is no disorderly default. It will mean hundreds of billions of euros over the decade, debt forgiveness, etc. There are no good choices. And Europe will all too soon face what to do with Portugal, which will want to dispense some haircuts of its own. Don't forget Ireland, which is very serious about not paying the debt the previous government took on for its banks in order to pay British, German, and French banks. That is a default that is in the cards. I think polite Ireland is just waiting until its $60 billion default is seen as small potatoes, which will be not too long, as Italy must raise almost 350 billion euros just to roll over current debt. Italy projects that its deficit will be down to 2%, but if Europe goes into recession, that projection goes out of the window. The bottom line is that Italy, and most likely Spain at some point, cannot raise the debt it needs at rates it can afford without massive European Central Bank involvement. Rates are already approaching 7% again. That is unsustainable from an Italian point of view. Germany must be willing to allow the ECB to take on massive balance sheet debt, or Italy will not make it without haircuts. And a mere 10% haircut for Italy dwarfs what is happening in Greece and doesn't do much for Italy. If they go for a haircut, it will be much larger. French banks hold 45% of Italian debt. Italy is quite simply too big for France to save. They cannot even backstop their banks if Italy becomes a solvency risk. They simply cannot get their hands on that much money without destroying their balance sheet. The most recent downgrade of their debt was just the first of many. And by the way, speaking of downgrades, Egan Jones downgraded Germany from AA to AA- and put the country on negative watch. This is important as this is what I believe to be the most credible rating agency. And over 95% of the time, the other big three agencies generally follow their lead after a period of time. Part of the reason for the downgrade is all the debt Germany is guaranteeing. Sean Egan was one of the first serious analysts to suggest that Greece would default. He was talking of 95% eventual default a long time ago. Europe will have to make its choice this year. Either a much tighter, more constrictive fiscal union with a central bank that can aggressively print euros in this crisis, or a breakup, either controlled or not. I don't think they can kick the can until 2013. The market will not allow it. Either the ECB takes off its gloves and gets down to real monetization when Italy and Spain need it, or the wheels quite simply come off. Ladies and gentlemen, as I've said so many, many times, there is absolutely no solution. No solution exists. All they can do is postpone the disaster a little longer. But things are definitely quickening now, and it's going to be very hard to kick that can down the road past March the 20th. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, we are coming up to the halfway mark, and I think if Matt is willing, we shall take this opportunity to have our break, and then we'll be right back, and I shall be talking in more detail about that which I told you I would be discussing, i.e. debt. We need to talk about it, we shall, and we will, and so let's take a break, and I'll be right back. Okay, we are back. All right, well, if you, ladies and gentlemen, increased your credit card spending by a couple of $1,000 a month, your lifestyle would improve. By going into large amounts of debt, it is possible to live a lifestyle that you can't really afford. But if you keep racking up huge amounts of credit card debt every single month, eventually it gets to a point where it's extremely difficult to even keep up with the minimum monthly payments, and the credit card companies will not lend you any more money. Well, on a larger scale, it's the same thing with government debt. Right now, the U.S. government is spending more than $1 trillion than it takes in every year. Even if the government spends all that money, it still gets into the pockets of ordinary Americans. In turn, those ordinary Americans use that money to pay the mortgage, buy food, shop at the mall, etc. And all of this borrowing and spending by the government has created a false prosperity bubble that isn't real. It may feel real to you right now, but it is unsustainable by definition. If the U.S. government started spending only the money that it brought in actually every year, the economy would be doomed and all of this false prosperity would rapidly disappear. If the government continues to rack up its debt at this pace, the country is doomed as well. In fact, every dollar that gets borrowed makes the eventual collapse ever worse. The U.S. is heading down the exact same road that Greece has gone. Eventually, the rest of the world is not going to lend America gigantic mountains of super cheap money anymore. When the flow of cheap money stops, it can be extremely painful. Anyone who has ever seen the interest rates on their credit cards go up above 20% know how this feels. If we had addressed these problems as a nation a decade or two ago, perhaps there would have been a solution. But now, and this is what it's so important to understand, there is no way out. A devastating economic collapse is on the horizon, no matter what is done. If there was a Hollywood movie where some crook successfully stole $150 million, what would you think of those crooks? Would you have admiration for them? Would you be disgusted with them? Would you feel like your intelligence was insulted because nobody could ever steal $150 million and get away with it? Well, right now, the federal government is stealing approximately $150 million from America's children, grandchildren, every single hour. That's right. The government is borrowing an astounding $150 million an hour that its children and grandchildren will be expected to deal with. It is a theft so vast that it is almost unimaginable. A lot of people out there think that America's problems would be solved if the government would just quit borrowing so much money. Well, it's just not that simple. Look at Greece. They were forced by the European Union and the IMF to dramatically reduce government spending. But when Greece reduced government spending, that caused the economy to shrink rapidly, and it caused tax receipts to go down more than expected. So, obviously, Greek budget deficits were even larger than anticipated, and so Greece was forced to cut spending even more. But that created even more economic problems. In a recent article by John Maudlin described the nightmarish effect that this cycle has had on Greece. And I quote, "And as Greece began shaken-baking its way to austerity, so-called, the very act of cutting deficits pushed the country into recession, which lowered tax revenues and increased expenses, putting the elusive goal of a balanced budget even further off. We should quickly note that this is not just a Greek problem. Spain's draconian cuts have meant that its 6% deficit target for the year has this week been raised to a more likely 8%, making it harder to get back to even. For country after country, this is the end game. It is the end of the debt supercycle. Debt has grown to the size that it cannot be sustained. The market will not lend any more money on terms that can be afforded, and any efforts to cut spending and raise taxes will result in an even worse economy in various degrees of recession with falling revenues and rising costs." End of quote. And that's exactly what we're seeing played out right in front of our eyes this very morning, ladies and gentlemen. You see, this is what happens when a country that has been spending far beyond its means is forced to cut back so dramatically. Those convinced that balancing a federal budget in the United States will be relatively painless should take a close look at what's happening in Greece. The Greek economy has been plunged into a 21st century Great Depression. In Greece, 20% of all retail stores have already shut down. The unemployment rate for those under the age of 24 is 39%. And one-third of the entire nation is living in poverty. And this is only just the beginning for Greece. Things are going to get much worse. Many believe that the United States is destined to experience far worse pain than Greece is currently experiencing. For example, Peter Schiff insists that the United States is in worse financial shape than Europe at this point. Anyone trying to downplay the U.S. debt position is making a serious mistake. Being able to borrow trillions of dollars for next to nothing is going to come to an end. Remember what happened to all those suckers that signed up for mortgages at teaser rates that later got jacked up dramatically? When the rates went up, many of them ended up losing everything. Well, the United States as a country, is in exactly the same position. All this cheap money has enabled the population to live very nicely for now. But when the cheap money ends, the nightmare will begin. Right now, the debt is growing much faster than the economy. Between 2007 and 2010, GDP in the U.S. grew by only 4.26%. But the U.S. national debt soared by 61% during that same time period. Think what your household finances would look like if your total debt grew by 61% next year, but your income only grew by 4%. Many years ago, the U.S. national debt was considered to be a huge national crisis. Politicians from both major political parties were promising that they would fix things. But since Ronald Reagan took office, the national debt was less than $1 trillion, and today it's over $15.2 trillion. During 2011, the federal government went into more debt than the government accumulated from the time that George Washington became president to the time that Ronald Reagan became president. During fiscal 2011, the government spent $3.7 trillion, but only brought in $2.4 trillion. Ladies and gentlemen, that is utter insanity. And yet most Americans have become convinced that this is normal and that there is nothing to worry about. And things look even worse when you look at the balance sheet of the government. The government has total assets of $2.7 trillion and total liabilities of $17.5 trillion. And by the way, those liabilities don't even count $4.7 trillion of the intergovernmental debt that it's currently outstanding. But it's not just the federal government that's been living a fantasy. Consumers, businesses, government officials, they've all been on a debt binge that is absolutely unprecedented. A recent Gallup poll found that satisfaction with government in the United States is now at an all-time record low of 29%. You know, it's not capitalism that's the problem. Capitalism has produced the greatest era of prosperity that the world has ever seen. No, the real problem is the debt-based financial system, which is managed and run by the central banks of the world. You actually could have capitalism without any debt whatsoever. But what we have today is a financial system that has debt as its very foundation. And such a system is inevitably going to fail one of these days. The Federal Reserve, of course, is at the very heart of the economic problems in the U.S. The Fed was just designed to be a perpetual debt machine. And yes, it has performed that task very well. The U.S. national debt is now more than 5,000 times larger than it was when the Federal Reserve was first created. So even though things seem somewhat stable for the moment, there are all kinds of reasons to be concerned about the viability of the economy and the financial system in the years ahead. A great economic storm is coming. Don't let this false prosperity and this calm before the storm fool you. We are living in the greatest debt bubble the world has ever seen. And no matter how it plays out, there is going to be a massive amount of pain. All right, well, I came across this gem from Bill Bonner. I'm sure you are aware, those of you who've listened to the wake-up call for some years, I do quote him quite frequently. And today is no exception. So here goes. Last night, we watched TV. There was a show called Killing Bin Laden. We do not normally react to political commentary, except to laugh. but the Killing Bin Laden show gave us the creeps. We laughed, but it was a bitter, worried laugh. The show describes, with evident pride, how a group of American soldiers trained carefully and used the latest gee-whiz military hardware to murder unarmed, apparently completely innocent people. Encountering Bin Laden's wife, for example, the soldiers made no attempt to protect her or to rescue her. They just gunned her down. As appalling as this was, what happened next almost took our breath away. An expert appeared on screen. In a single sentence, this jackass excused the killing by saying it was permissible or some other claptrap. What exactly was his rationale, we don't know. He didn't say. Even in times of war, soldiers are not supposed to kill civilians. Heck, these soldiers probably shot his dog, too. You may be allowed to kill enemy combatants, which is a huge stretch for Bin Laden, but what kind of army kills their wives and children, too? If this expert doesn't go to hell, we'll be disappointed in the whole structure of heaven. Our History of the Jews book has made us think. It has a lot of instances of mass murder masquerading as military action. And then, when the Jews had been massacred, their cities destroyed, and their wives and children sold into slavery, they asked why their God had forsaken them. The prophets answered, "Because we forsook him." It was a good answer. They argued that the Jews had been corrupted by politics, and then they became its victims. Those who lived by the sword perished by it. Rough justice administered by God himself. So what's in store for a nation that makes heroes of the killers? We don't like to think. Rather pithy, I think. Well, in the Middle East, by the way, there are a number of countries that shook off the effects of the economic downturn and are still growing feverishly. If you're looking for a job, this may be a good place to start. Even a casual glance at the employment section of Gulf News, one of the region's leading publications based in Dubai, shows a number of well-paying positions available in a variety of fields. Things like marketing manager, $5,500 monthly. Bank branch manager, $8,200 monthly. Financial analyst, $15,000 monthly. Administrative assistant, $1,800 monthly. Warehouse supervisor, $1,700 monthly. Personal trainer, $2,750 monthly. Fashion retail shop manager, $2,200 monthly. Regional sales manager, $9,000 monthly. Business development manager, $9,500 monthly. Senior accountant, $11,000 monthly. Quality control specialist, $12,250 monthly. These jobs are available across the region from Abu Dhabi to Kurdistan. Yes, that is in Iraq. To Egypt, to Qatar, to in Lebanon. Most of the positions, especially the better-paying jobs, have great benefits. And no, I'm not talking about casual Friday. In this part of the world, it's common for employers to provide a house and chauffeured car in the package, and sometimes even private schooling for the kids. Commissions and profit shares are also common, depending on the position. And as an added benefit, most of these places have little or no tax, so you keep what you earn. And by way of comparison, if you'd make $4,000 a month, which is $48,000 annually in Abu Dhabi, that's the after-tax equivalent of making $65,000 a year in the U.S. And if you make $7,500 a month, that's $90,000 annually in Dubai, it's like making $130,000 in the U.S. And what's more, U.S. tax law excludes the first $92,900 from income tax. Other nationalities pay nothing. Right now, in the Gulf News jobs websites, there are hundreds of jobs that pay anywhere from 4,000 to over 16,000 jobs per month just waiting to be filled. So, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, my feeble attempt to try to be helpful. Hope it works out. Who knows? Okay, so, here's some more on unemployment, by the way. According to Reuters, the Obama administration estimates that through the course of 2012, about 6 million people will lose federally funded unemployment benefits if Congress doesn't act. Currently, federal money ensures that the unemployment receive benefits for up to 99 weeks in states where joblessness is high. Ending the program would mean that the newly unemployed would have to rely on state programs that usually last for only 26 weeks. Extended benefits have been renewed several times as the economy struggled to mount a vigorous recovery from the 2007 to 2009 recession, the worst since the Great Depression. According to Christine Owens, Executive Director of National Employment Law Project, the average unemployed worker receiving extended benefits gets just $296 a week, and I quote, "That represents only 50% of the income needed to cover the most basic necessities of food, housing, and transportation," she said. End of quote. The extended federal benefits have become a target in the fight over budget policy between Republicans and Democrats, and renewal is uncertain. Analysts warn that removing the cushion from the million of unemployed would dampen the still fragile economic recovery. Quote, "If the unemployed do not have the money to spend, then spending in the economy is going to decline. Providing unemployment benefits is one of the effective ways to create jobs." End of quote. And that comes from Lawrence Mitchell, head of the Liberal Economic Policy Institute in Washington. Those opposed to extending the benefits, including the Conservative Heritage Foundation, argue that they have failed to stimulate the economy and are instead encouraging recipients to continue seeking jobs that do not exist. Half the jobs lost during the downturn were in manufacturing and construction. Most of them are not going to be recovered. The Heritage Foundation says raising the benefits to 99 weeks has increased the unemployment rate by half a percentage point. Quote, "People are trying to find jobs similar to what they had previously when those jobs completely don't exist. And so they will spend a good portion of their period unemployed looking for jobs that they are unlikely to find." End of quote. And that's from James Shirk, a senior policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. And continuing, "The only sound arguments for extended unemployment benefits are humanitarian. About 43% of the 13.3 million unemployed Americans have been out of work for 27 weeks and more, according to Harry Holzer, professor of public policy at Georgetown University in Washington. Most of the long-term unemployed are people who had pretty good jobs, and these jobs were permanently eliminated. If they exhaust their benefits, what are their options?" End of quote. Already the labor force participation rate, the percentage of working-age Americans either with a job or looking for one, is at 28-year lows. And while many experts advocate retraining, especially for those who lost their jobs in construction and some sections of manufacturing, Holzer warned that that will not necessarily help older unemployed workers like Parks. Quote, "For people who are in their 50s, it's harder to go back and retrain. A 55-year-old with a brand new degree is less attractive than a 25-year-old with the same degree," he said. Analysts say that some of the long-term unemployed could end up settling for lesser-paying jobs, but even those are in short supply. For every one job opening, there are about 4.6 people. And again from Michelle. "It means there are simply no jobs available for more than 3 out of 4 unemployed workers. In a given month in today's labor market, the vast majority of the unemployed are not going to find a job, no matter what they do." Well, the treaty that left Britain stranded a few weeks ago, as the lone voice out of 27 is already falling apart. France will not schedule a bicameral parliamentary vote for a constitutional budget balancing rule, while the opposition Socialist Party remains opposed to the idea. And that's according to Valérie Pécresse, the government spokesman. Quote, there can be no question of holding a vote until the opposition changes its position. Sarkozy's efforts to get a fiscal rule enshrined in the constitution have been thwarted by left-wing opposition, but he and German Chancellor Angela Merkel said on Monday they would seek a European Union backing by March to have such clauses put into law across the Eurozone. Sarkozy is still willing to write clauses in the treaty, even though he does not have the necessary votes to deliver them. The Supreme Court in Germany has not yet ruled on some of the proposed treaty modification, notably the 85% rule that has Finland upset. Nonetheless, Sarkozy and Merkel will plod along with their attempt to ram a treaty down the throats of the 17 at a complete taxpayer expense, thanks to Merkel caving in to a Sarkozy demand, when it is highly likely their own countries cannot deliver the votes. It's surprising how long it took the markets to see through the agreement that was set up in December to set up a separate treaty to reinforce the current one. As the Frankfurter Allgemeine reports, the European Commission believes the whole thing is legally doubtful and mostly irrelevant. In the Commission's view, there is hardly anything really new in the Euro agreement, and what is new is legally really doubtful. And according to the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, the main problem, according to the Commission, is that the agreement for quasi-automatic sanctions would be part of an intergovernmental treaty and an international law that is of lesser legal value than a European treaty. As a consequence, any country's request to proceed according to the weaker deficit rules of the European treaty would mean that the stricter rules according to the intergovernmental treaty cannot be applied. Also, the Commission points out that it is doubtful that it and the European Court of Justice can legally be asked to perform surveillance duties on behalf of a subgroup of the European Union. The objections of Finland are no mere formality. And it still remains to be seen if Sweden, Hungary and the Czech Republic parliaments are willing to go along. They would be foolish to do so. Well, I came across this comparison chart, courtesy of the CIA, which sets America's healthcare statistics off against France, and this is what I found. Infant mortality in the United States, 6.06 per 1,000 live births. Infant mortality rate in France, 3.29 per 1,000 live births. Average life expectancy in the United States, 78.37 years, 75.92 for men, 80.93 for women. Average life expectancy in France, 81.19 years, 78.2 for men, 84.54 for women. Total expenditure on healthcare in the United States, 16.2% of GDP, that's from 2009. Total expenditure on healthcare in France, 3.5% of GDP, also 2009 figures. So expenditure on healthcare in the United States per capita, 7,517 per year, also from 2009. Expenditure on healthcare in France per capita, $1,148 per year, also from 2009. So when you break it down per person per year, the French spend less than one-sixth of what the United States spends, yet live longer and have a lower infant mortality rate. Well, I guess that speaks for itself too. Well, the triumphant individual myth feeds the notion of the U.S. as a kind of land of unbounded opportunity, from a country where anyone, no matter how impoverished his or her initial surroundings, can carve out a decent life by hard work. A recent New York Times article reported, and I quote, "Americans enjoy less economic mobility than their peers in Canada and much of Western Europe," end of quote. The explanation is the circumstances of your family of origin. If you are born into poverty, you tend to stay there, whereas if you're born into affluence, you tend to continue to live in affluence. Continuing to quote, "Above 62% of Americans, male and female, raised in the top fifth of incomes, stay in the top two-fifths. Similarly, 65% born in the bottom fifth stay in the bottom two-fifths." End of quote. You see, the trouble is, America has become a nation of narcissists. For many Americans, the core value is not e pluribus unum, but rather, what's in it for me? And as a consequence, the safety net has been shredded. Poor kids aren't as likely to get small classes, pre- and after-school care, food, health care, and decent housing. And America pays its blue-collar workers less than they do in Canada and Europe. America's lack of social mobility is a national disgrace. Well, finally, Bill Sheehan, a question. "Dear Richard, suppose one moves to Latin America. How do you arrange for your funds to be safe there?" The answer, very simply, is that there are many countries which will allow you to open a bank account, Bill, without having to be in place. Singapore isn't one of them, but Argentina is, Brazil is, and Uruguay is. So basically, you can just go there, and even if you can probably do it through one of their branches in New York, but not to worry, you can make arrangements long before you get there. So don't worry, it can be done. So, Bill, thank you for the question. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Richard Martin. We have sadly come to the end of another wake-up call. I will be back with you on Friday, same time, same place. Have a great week. Take care. Bye-bye.